Hey, wonderfuls, welcome to episode 401 of the podcast. We have crossed over the beautiful line of 400 episodes. I want to thank all of you who checked in and expressed a hello and a mild congrats and all of the great stuff you said about Jonathan and getting to do the little song that she was patient enough to agree to do with me. No, she's so amazing and she was more than patient. She was inviting and warm and wonderful, and I feel like I can call her a friend now, which is very exciting. I also am very excited for you to listen to this episode with Nagin Farsad. I am kind of obsessed with her. She's definitely one of those guests where I feel like I should just be able to call her up whenever I want now, because she's so accessible and funny and delightful and inspiring, and I can't wait for you to familiarize yourselves with her if you have not already. I'm sure many of you have, but she's so great. I just have a huge friend crush on her. So enjoy this episode. I hope everyone is staying safe and well as we just plod our way through this winter, thinking about you. I've been doing my mashes, and they have been so much fun. So that has been a real highlight of my quarantine since I started doing them with you guys. All right, I hope everyone's well, and talk to you soon. How are you? Where are you? What's happening?
I'm in New York City. And I don't know when listeners are going to be listening to this, but it's that interesting time a couple days before Thanksgiving where you're still working really hard, but your heart's not in it at all.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where I'm at psychologically.
In a year where who knows where anyone's heart has been in what for pretty much the entire year since March.
The entire time. Yeah. What have we all been doing and thinking? It is unclear. Well, you know, it's interesting because I have felt, you know, fine and then burnout and then fine and then burnout. I go into really fun burnout cycles where and then I have these days where I act like the pandemic is only happening to me.
I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah. Like, and I'll just like cry to my husband, just like, why? And he's like, you realize this is global? Okay, just check.
I know. I wonder how many of us have said, I'm not sure I've said these exact words, but you know that some of us have said the literal words, why is this happening to me? You know people are saying that.
Yes. It's funny because it's also funny how many stages of pandemic we've been in or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Because in the very first week I was supposed to do a particular show, and I don't think it matters. Wait, don't tell me an NPR.
Yeah.
And normally we tape that in Chicago or around the country, different spots or whatever. I was supposed to fly to Chicago, and I honestly, to like the last moment, thought that this was still gonna happen, that I was gonna fly to Chicago on the first days of a pandemic when literally the entire globe had just shut down. Like, this is post Tom Hanks, right? And I'm talking to one of the producers who's calling me, and they were like, listen, you're actually not gonna fly to Chicago. We've determined that would be entirely reckless. But we'll send you to the New York studio, and that's how all the comedians will do it, whatever, from various NPR studios around the country.
Yeah.
Like, fantastic, great. So then they call me and they're like, turns out, like, NPR does not want garbage comedians up in their building, like, sneezing on all the surfaces. So we're going to have to we're going to have to cancel you for this week and just use LA comedians, because, like, LA NPR had looser standards. No, I don't know why. There was just, like, some weird whatever. I'm not trying to besmirch NPR. They're wonderful. But then, you know, because it was like day three or four of pandemic, I just start bawling to an NPR producer like a lunatic, because I just was like, I don't know. It just hit me. in that call, and I was like, I'm a comedian. Will I ever work again? Like, I didn't say those words to her. I tried to maintain some professional integrity on this call, but I was crying. You know what I mean? Like, can you imagine crying to an employer? Like, that's crazy.
I'm sorry to say I can. So don't worry.
And like, I've since, I apologized to her afterward. You know what I mean? I was like, I'm so, I, all of my emotions happened, just so happened to happen on that one call. You know,
I'm sure she thought that. I'm sure she was like, I'm a human person. I'm a human being. I feel those feelings. Couldn't understand better. Yeah.
No, she obviously, she was fantastic. It was just like, but it's so interesting where your, when your body decides to understand feelings.
Oh my God, absolutely. Well, listen, I feel like you clearly were more healthily processing than many of us. I mean, I was definitely sort of in a fog. And I had a similar situation where everything, it was like, you know, somehow work, and maybe this is true for a lot of people, but somehow work did seem to be like business as usual. I don't even know if I've talked about it on the podcast. Maybe I probably have. I mean, come on. What else have we had to talk about this pandemic? But
you're just on repeat. I'm not even speaking to the real you. This is a recording of stuff you've already said.
That's right. And sadly, it's still like 4 months ago. You're getting a recording from 4 months ago because that's how confident I was that nothing would have changed. But I was on a show that shot before a live studio audience, and I was sitting in the makeup chair when we found out that South By had been canceled, and I had this moment where I was looking at my phone, and you know that my partner for Sketchfest texted me, because obviously, like you, I have a vested interest in live events of the comedy nature. And texted me and said South By just got canceled, like right before it was about to happen. And I very dramatically was like, oh my God. And everyone was like, what? What? And I was like, they just canceled South By Southwest. And everyone was like, whoa. And then two people go, what is South By Southwest? So it was so anticlimactic. And then I did this thing where I looked around where I was like, I mean, you're right, you guys. Like, I looked around like, can you believe these people don't know what it is? And then I realized I was in a room full of people who work on like television shows that have exactly. And so I was like trying to, and so then I said something, and then to a person I was sure would know, I said, but did you hear what I said? They just canceled South By Southwest. And she was like, oh my God, that's crazy. And then someone next to her said, what is South By Southwest? And she said, it's a big country music festival.
Oh no.
Yeah, so it was a very anticlimactic moment where I thought I was going to like record scratch the whole room and everyone would just drop what they were holding and there would be a shattering of glass. Instead, people were like, what is it? What are you talking about?
You just had to be like, it's like Tom Hanks, but with a film festival.
Well, but and also like,
it's like the NBA, but a film festival.
But even that, like, even I... Because I was like, well, you know, it's like part, you know, it's comedy, but then it's like film festival, but then it's like a music component.
Right,
there's a tech component.
A digital component.
And then I was like,
Let
me just see who was, because I hadn't paid that much attention either to like what was happening that given year, except I had friends who, to your point, did have films that were supposed to premiere there. But I was like, let me just see who's speaking. And I pulled it up and it was like Michelle Obama. Like, it was like everyone famous you've ever heard of. So I felt slightly vindicated, yet also kind of sheepish that I myself did not know that those people were supposed to have been there. But then after that, still like the next week or whatever, it was like still kind of business as usual, where I was getting like, you know, the update for like, okay, the table read will be on Monday, and then we'll go ahead and, you know, shoot the show in front of a live audience and, you know, on that Friday. And that was still being told to me while the mayor of Los Angeles was like shutting everything down. So it was very similar to what you had,
it's
where
so
it was like,
weird.
No, we're still on. Okay, couple updates. Yeah, updates. We're going to go ahead and do it this way. It's okay. Next new update. We're not doing it at all. And then it just like slowly closed down. Yeah.
That's, I know, I was supposed to do a Kennedy Center thing and it was like that. It was like, show is going to go on. It's going to be great. See you guys there. And then the next one was just like, okay, show is going to happen, but it's going to happen for like a 75% full audience, but we'll see you there. Okay, see you there. No, show's going to happen. It's just going to happen at 50%. No, this time it's going to happen at, you know what? We're going to do the show. It's going to be to an empty audience and three custodial staff. Okay, and then, but we'll see you there. Like it was nonstop. Yes. Just, they couldn't, you know, decide what it was that was going to happen. Yes. Craziness. Yeah. Really? But it has been interesting how I feel like I've also been busier.
Mm-hmm. Same.
I think, it's interesting. You strip away the commute time and it turns out you're a lot more miserable, I think is what I've learned.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I physically go to other cities all the time. Yeah. Like that's what my normal life is. I'm flying, you know, to Chicago or to Austin or to wherever to do shows. And I thought that was an inconvenience. And it is, I mean, an inconvenience. Yeah. But I also didn't realize that it was the thing that kept me going.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Totally. Just like, it's like I was having, when the first sort of wave of pandemic lunches started to happen outdoors and you were like, started to reconnect with people in a safe way. I was just like, it turns out I need 10 to 15 human interactions a day, like with 10 to 15 different people to feel normal. I have been deeply deprived, and I think for the extroverts, it's a tough one to like not have the constant, I feel like a vulture, like I'm a people vulture. Like I need to feed off of the energy of other people to be alive.
Yeah.
Like, is this what a vampire is?
I was
going
to say, I like that you use something that does exist in the natural world as if you were like, I'm not going as far as vampire because those aren't real, but I am a vulture.
I take conversation very
seriously. I am a vulture, and I guess that means I feed off of dead people because I think they're scavengers. So let's amend this. Hold on. It's a V word.
Yeah,
it's a V
word. That's not right at all. But I am a social like energy vampire or something.
And would you have said that before all of this? Because like I do feel like that's sort of, there's a point at which that kind of came up in the zeitgeist in terms of like what an introvert versus an extrovert, and like you had those conversations. And I did know, I think I thought I was an extrovert for a long time, and then I realized that I am actually an introvert who loves people. But I have not had quite the same experience as you, and yet on our surfaces, I feel like people would be like, "Oh, they're both this.
Oh, you're
like,
both
whatever
extra,
you guys
yeah,
are.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
the same. Like whatever, whichever one it
no,
is."
No, Janet, I have never lived alone. I really loved always having a roommate.
Yeah.
You know, before I moved in with my man, I just aggressively had a roommate. I didn't even necessarily have to, but I aggressively had a roommate. And I was like a totally, like a serial monogamous when it came to roommates. Like people would live with me forever. And, you know, because I don't mean
that
to brag.
Well,
I don't
want
to
brag. You're clearly a great roommate. Yeah.
I'm a great roommate. I'm like pretty clean. I take out the stuff. I have a chat when you need to have a chat, but I also know when to shut up.
Yeah.
Like, but I just need to like come home to someone. It can't be. And I remember thinking, in my 20s, like, oh my God, what if I never like get married or something? Am I just going to have roommates until like my 60s? Like, am I just going to be some sort of octogenarian with a roommate? And I just was like, yeah.
Dude, I'll tell you this. Like, first of all, I said dude somehow. That's how enthusiastic I feel about you, is that like this kid that thinks they're like a skateboarder kicks in and I suddenly say things like dude. So this is a compliment to you. But
No, the Southern California in me appreciates it.
Oh, man.
It.
I'm telling you, that's so good because I feel like, you know, we're one conversation away from sitting down with a doctor and the doctor being like, you, Janet, will have dementia. You, Nagin, you're going to be fine. Because, like, so much of, you know, I think the more introverted you are, the more likely it is that you don't notice the absence of that stimuli, right? And so you do, right. And I speak from experience, like, my mom is, like, the most introvertiest introvert ever, and she fully had early onset dementia. So I mean, this is not a very pleasant conversation, but I truly like that is yeah. a big part of it is like, oh, she just, no one was there like to sort of stimulate, check in,
to have like a chat,
to have a chat, to challenge her, to, you know, widen her horizons in that way. And so it happened to her early, and she was able to hide it from everyone. And, you know, it was just like it. So I really have made the conscious decision, like, I don't care what's happening in my life. I always will be around at least someone, if not multiple people, in some kind of meaningful and profound way, because I got to stay sharp. I gotta stay sharp, and you're gonna stay sharp naturally. I mean, you're always gonna be naturally sharp.
Yeah, because I just need it on like a, yeah, you know, I just need it more. But to feel happy, like, I think that's the, you know, I can get into like, you know, little mini states of depression if I don't get my dose. And I think, you know, but I also think the thing that's happening that you're talking about is also just like a big fat national problem. I mean, the UK has a minister of happiness. I think it's called a minister of happiness, because so many people are kind of retreating into their silos and they don't have enough communication, enough contact with others. Yeah. And it's really, you know, it's a real national epidemic, an international epidemic, because I think it's not, I think back in the day, introverts like your mom, people were just like up in their business because of the way that communities were structured. Yeah. You had to go, the milkman, he showed up, you know, you had to go get your meat from the butcher, so he knew what your deal was. Yeah. You had to do this, you had to, there was just a lot more built in human interaction, yes, into the way that our communities were set up. Yeah. And the way things are now, which is why I am so also hell bent on living a kind of like, I almost live like it's still the 1950s, you know what I mean? Because I go to specialty shops to buy my things, because I'm also like one of these Save Our Storefront motherfuckers who just like is endlessly obsessed with like small business and supporting community and all that
love
stuff,
it.
Whatever. But I know I'm like, ugh, but like, no, I really am. I'm devoted to those things. And so as a result, I just feel like I put myself out there more to small businesses, to the other moms at the playground, to the, you know, the neighbors. You're always going to get a hey from me. And it's honestly, I think it keeps my blood pressure down.
Yes.
If I don't do the, hey, what's up, let's talk about the weather. Oh my God, do I love a conversation about the weather. Yeah. I will kill a conversation about the weather. You know what I mean? You like stand next to me at a stoplight and I am just like, oh, look at those shoes, they're cute. Or like, you know, I mean, I will find something because I need to feel like I'm around humans and that ultimately we all care about each other,
well,
which is so...
Yeah.
Anyway, dorky, but it's
no,
true.
No, and I will say, see, again, it's so interesting because all of those things are true for me as well. It's just I have to know I'm going to have time alone. Like, it's not, I have to know I'm going to have time alone to sort of re-up. I'll go to Comic-Cons and spend 12 hours meeting people and talking to people and back in the day and hugging people back in the day when you could hug,
right.
And you know, and I'll just give it 1,000%. But I'm not the person who has anything left to like go out to dinner with your friends afterwards. Like I leave it all on the field and then I have to like go back and sort of have like the time for 3 hours where I don't talk to anyone and I'm just like watching a movie in the room or I go for a jog or I like wander around walking somewhere. But I 100% agree with you that the sort of connectivity is vital. We have termites not in our house, but like in the sort of wood fence kind of railing leading up to the house, and we had to have that, you know, treated.
Is someone making meth in your house while it's being
someone
treated
is
for
yes okay, someone is making meth. I'm a traditionalist in that way. Someone asked me to make him mad. But I realized he's come to our house once before to do a check and he was very nice and we just remembered him very fondly. And so it wasn't like he was a total stranger. I don't think it would have mattered if he were, because it was like you meeting your conservative Republican white male middle-aged your mirror image, kind of like that's what it was for. Like imagine that person. Being like, oh, we're crossing the divide of polarity in this nation because we both want to be respectful and learn from each other. And like somehow he showed up at 3 and somehow at 4:15 he had not done anything. Like somehow we got into this conversation. We were just standing outside, like 8 feet apart with our masks on. Like, and I understand. And I mean, it was crazy. It was like, listen, and Rick, I get it, Rick. Look, I understand. Look, I'm not, do I think it's fair that they open casinos before they open churches? Of course not. I think that's awful. Like we were just getting so in the weeds with each other. And in my mind, I was like, this is going to heal our nation. Like we all need an in-person pen pal.
What I'm getting from this story is that everyone should have termites that need to be treated. Termites, they bring people together. That's the new tagline for termites.
Yes, you boil it down to its soul and core. Yes, you all need termites because that's the only way our nation is going to get, if we're going to heal through this.
But anyway, it was a nice conversation. Yeah. Like you felt,
I felt did you so hopeful when I walked inside. I barely stopped talking about it. And this was last week. Like I can't tell you how much I appreciated feeling like it was a guy who, I don't know, it was just one of those like perfect, I mean, he was sort of a poster child for the person who voted for Biden, this time, but did vote for Trump last time,
just didn't.
He's a, you know, just a, like a, like a true Christian, like not a fake sort of Christian, not a sanctimonious Christian, more of a sincere Christian, and you know, is, you know, in his 60s and is, you know, married and has adult kids and lives outside of LA, so you know he's in that, you know, he sort of lives outside the bubble but comes into the city and has all these interactions with all these like annoying liberal like weirdos who are shrill, like me, I'm sure.
But he's a
total people person. And I felt like it was one of those perfect combinations where I felt really seen and really heard, and I felt like I was really hearing him, and I could feel where we both get our information. Like I could feel myself regurgitating the New York Times and the Washington Post. I could hear him regurgitating Fox News, and like, I just felt I felt such compassion for everyone in this nation. I was like, oh, like, but there are a bunch of people like him out there. That's how I felt. I felt that there are a lot of people out there who are not in a hurry to hate anyone, are not super excited to be made to feel like they're stupid idiot racists. And that's not going to work to get anything to change.
It
was just that. It was just a feeling of like, oh my God, neither one of us are angry right now at each other or really about anything. And we're just both really hopeful that things are going to be okay. And And I really was like high from it. I was high from it.
I love that. First of all, you know, look, I'm an Iranian American Muslim, as listeners can tell from my voice.
Clearly.
And what one of the things that I've done a lot, like with my comedy, is, you know, on various occasions, I've like rounded up a bunch of Muslim American comedians in a nonviolent way. And I've gone around the country and I've done shows, right? Like I've performed, you know, the week after the 2016 elections, I was in South Carolina performing. Right. Like I was in Laramie. I was in Wyoming. Yeah. I was in South Dakota performing. Right. Yeah. Like what I like to do is go to places where you wouldn't expect a Muslim comedian, you know, and so a lot of the stuff that I've done has been about me trying to meet those people.
Right.
And there are so many more of those people. The like rhetoric that 70 million people voted for Trump are racist, I don't buy into that. And I'm saying this again as someone, like, not that my identity matters, but I will note, as someone who I said is Muslim but also married to a black man and has a biracial baby, like,
yeah.
I do not think that 70 million people are racist. Do I think some of those people are racist?
For sure.
But I think that when we're looking at mainstream people and we're looking at the way that information is dispersed, you know, I remember being in I think we were in Tennessee, and we walked into this store, and for some reason, it came up. This woman was like asking about my name or my, you know, she was trying to figure out where I was from or whatever. Oh yeah, I'm Iranian, whatever, we're Muslim, blah blah. And she said, "What do you think?" And this is something that was documented in my second film, "The Muslims Are Coming," and she said, "What do you think of 9/11?" Right, which I think. If you get that question on Twitter, then you're going to be rageful,
right,
and crazy, and you know it's going to be endless. Like, let's troll this person until they shut down their account. How could they ask me that question?
Right.
But to see this woman, right, she was like a 70-year-old woman who ran, you know, a vintage shop in some cute town in Tennessee. And she, like, honestly wanted to know.
Yeah, this is her chance to, like,
she's
get
literally
a sense of you.
Exactly. And because she's never met a Muslim probably since,
right,
you know, or she, you know, she hasn't had a chance to be chatty with,
yeah,
one. And here I am, you know, 5'3" and a half. The half really counts, guys. And I dress like a cartoon character. And I'm just, like, willing to chat about anything.
Yeah.
So, of course, she's going to ask me. And that wasn't the first question that came out of her mouth, but like after 20 minutes,
yeah,
of like thinking that you're in a quote unquote safe,
yep,
space with someone in a conversation, hey, why not say, what do you think of 9/11? And I was just like, oh, like, what do you think I would think? It's horrible.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so she needed to hear,
yeah,
that, but she also, it's like she needed to hear it from
yes,
a human,
yes,
being that wasn't going to judge,
yes,
her for the question.
Yes, yes, yes.
And we spend so much time judging people for the question. And we spend so much time being sanctimonious, it makes me crazy,
yeah,
that we sort of have like all but forgotten that it's possible to exist in another context,
yeah,
you know, exist in a context where you're not getting, where the first thing you say isn't, I was listening to All Things Considered and I noticed, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's not how,
yeah,
a lot of people start their sentences.
Correct.
And I know it is how I might start some of my sentences.
Right.
And I am the stereotype of that person. But it's okay that there are people that don't start their sentences that way. And then they're getting their information in different fashion.
Yeah.
And we need to reckon with that and be okay with,
yeah,
it.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
Well, hello. I'm Renee Colvert.
Hi, I'm Alexis Preston. And we are the hosts of Can I Pet Your Dog?
And we got breaking news. We got an expose. And all the beans have been spilled via an Apple Podcast review that said, this show isn't well-researched. Well, yeah, no duh. Of course it's not. Not since the day we started has it been well researched. Guessing and anthropomorphizing dogs is what we do.
The Can I Pet Your Dog promise is that we will never do more than 10 seconds of research before telling you excitedly about any dog we see.
I'm gonna come at you with top 10 enthusiasm, minimal facts.
We're here for a good time, not an educated time.
So if you love dogs and you don't love research, well, you know what? Come on in to Can I Pet Your Dog podcast every Tuesday on Maximum Fun Network.
It sounds like perhaps you've always been very open and available. Is that fair to say? And is that something that your parents kind of instilled in you? Like, how did you, like, what, I mean, obviously we all know what the context of my podcast is. Like, let's just get right down to it. Drop it in here. Let's drop you into high school. Drop you into 15-year-old, 16-year-old version
yes,
of you.
Yes.
Like, how much of that person were you then?
Young Nagin. I mean, I think part of the thing with, I grew up in Palm Springs, California, which is also like generally a weird place to have grown up because it's like a resort town. So I was essentially a townie, you know what I mean? And other people enjoyed Palm Springs as a resort town. Like people would often ask me like after, you know, I'm going to Palm Springs for vacation. Where should I go? And I'd be like, I don't know, like the Denny's on Highway 111 was a great place that we hung out a lot. And there's a place called the Circles, which was just like circles that didn't have houses on them yet. There are people used to do some weed there. Yes. Where else could you go? So that's like, you know, my Palm Springs is that. And so we didn't have any other, like there was one other Muslim family, Iranian family in Palm Springs that was like, I went to school with their kids.
There was one high school.
Yeah. So I went, so one of the guys was in my class. And then if you're in that situation, which a lot of like first generation people are, a lot of hyphenated Americans are, there's so many. But you can also be hyphenated in a many different ways. It could be via class. It could be that your parents moved from Boston to Palm Springs and you were the only, you know, New Englander. I mean, people have like various ways of being hyphenated and special. But for me, yeah, there was one other. My high school was 2,000 people. I mean, it was a big school. Yeah. But the funny thing is like, I'd say we were, and these are numbers I'm pulling out of my dick, like 50% Mexican. And we didn't, you know, it's like I was in a really multicultural space, but none of the minorities that were heavily represented were Iranian, of course,
right,
you know.
Right.
And I think when you're in that situation, you just are like, I got to adapt.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I have no choice but to adapt, you know. I have no choice but to find meaning in MTV's The Real World, even though none of these characters address me specifically. Like, I have no choice but to look at Claire Danes in My So-Called Life and say, she is me, I is her.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And like, that is, I think, look, because these things are universal. It's not difficult at all for me, you know, to make that connection. You know
right.
what I mean? I feel just as comfortable with whiteness as maybe someone is uncomfortable with Muslimness, but whatever. but I think so. I think that's maybe what has made me so open. I also was a really special, like I was a real academic nerd. I was head of the debate team. Thank you. But I was also vice president of the theater club. So I was one of those really special crossover dorks,
right?
Who just really flourished in both sides. Of the dork divide.
Yeah.
And you know, and I was really I mean, I wanted to, I'm a comedian, but like I started out wanting to be like the first Muslim president of the United States. Amazing. You know what I mean? I was really committed to going into politics. Of course, Barack Obama beat me to it. But as the first Muslim president, hey,
Are you still really angry at him for like stealing your thunder? What with him being Muslim and everything? Or
I mean, I haven't read the new memoir, but I am assuming that there are secret Muslim messages. Like if you string together the first letter of every chapter, it's like our call to arms or something. And our call to arms is like, listen to my Spotify playlist, I'm Barack Obama, or something like that. That's mostly like what Muslims do. But yeah, I think I was really politically motivated. And so, even as a kid, I was always politically motivated. And I don't know where that came from or why that happened, but it happened. And I think because I was like in theater and I was doing a lot of comedy or whatever, like I do think I had a reputation of being kind of funny, but I also had a reputation of being a nerd. But I also, you know, I suffered the indignation of not being a hot girl. And I'm not saying I'm not hot. I just wasn't a hot girl in high school, with the blonde, narrow definitions. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I didn't have any of that. And, high school, I'm assuming, is still brutal. I mean, it was fucking brutal at times, with just people just straight up telling me that I was ugly or whatever. Good, you know, Lord. But you know, like that's kind of like high school,
right?
Not, you know, I remember I did this. This is like a chapter in my book. I wrote a book called How to Make White People Laugh, and I talk a lot about high school. There's this one. I'll just tell you like one of my more horrible memories of high school. I don't know if you feel free to cut it out.
So
I was in this play, and we were doing teasers of the play, which we would do for the entire school, but the entire school couldn't fit into the drama room at the same time, so they would break it up all throughout the day. So at each period of the day was a different part of the school coming to see, like, you know, 20 minutes or something of us performing. Okay. And we managed to get through the entire day. It's the final period is left, and it's a comedy. I'm in this comedy piece, whatever, and I can't remember what it was called, but I remember in the piece the main guy like has to choose between two women, and he's doing like a kind of monologue to the audience. What does that call it? Soliloquy, whatever. He's like talking to himself in front of the audience, and these two women are at either side, and they can't hear his thoughts or whatever. And he's just like, should I choose this woman or should I choose this woman? And so he's going through this like soliloquy. And I keep using soliloquy and then feeling like it's the wrong word. Doesn't matter. He was saying a thing, and then at some point he has to choose me ultimately, right? My character. But he's like, should I choose the girl in the black dress? That was me. Or the one in the red dress? So then he hemming and hawing, and he's going back and forth. He's like, should I go with the one with the black dress? And as he says that, the entire audience, and I think it was maybe 200 or 300 people in the room, start going, boo, she's fat, she's ugly. Okay. Just like straight up 300 people telling me that I am a hideous monster. And then because the other girl, she was actually like really hot, whatever. Anyway,
it seems like a great choice of whoever made the decision to do that piece at all in front of high school students. Like in every way, it seems offensive. What an invitation for disaster.
But it's like the disaster had not occurred throughout the entire other six periods. Yeah. It was like this one, you know? And
God, what section of the school was it? It was just like the bigots.
I remember because then he says, should I choose the other one? Everyone's like cheering for her or whatever. God. He chooses me, boo, whatever. Okay. So then I had to go backstage and change between because I had to do another scene. And so I'm just really holding back tears. Yeah. And I'm like unsuccessfully holding back tears. And the teacher comes out and she was just like, you've got this. You're a professional. You know, get back out there. You know what
you're
I mean?
Not the kind of person who's going to cry to a boss later in life. You're too professional for this. Let go of those tears. Put them away. You're not this person.
And so then I do that. And, you know, and then I finished that day of school and just quietly ran away. Oh. And, you know, my best friend ran to my house after, like, she had heard. And the news made it around campus. It was horrifying because it wasn't just that those 300 kids, you know, had done that to me, but it's that everybody knew about it. Right. So, you know, it was just horrible, horrible, horrible. But I think, interestingly, like, I mean, and I gotta be, I mean, like, I, you know, look, I don't, I'm not like an ugly person or whatever. Again, I'm just like not a traditional beauty in that sense. And I did, and obviously I had to get over a lot, and in high school is miserable for everybody because a lot of girls just think that about themselves anyway. Right. The fact that I had got to have this really great chorus of voices confirming those thoughts. but I think, you know, it's interesting because I also think that those, if I had to be sympathetic to them, it's that they were also they're living under the same patriarchy that I am. Right. Not to be like, hey, 15-year-old boys, you're living under the same patriarchy. Yeah. We didn't know those words, but we didn't understand these concepts, but we were being overruled by them, right, which is that we're teaching you the beauty is this one thing, that you should desire this one thing, and that everything outside of that one thing is considered ugly. Yeah. Right. And that it is okay to talk about women that way. All of these are just lessons that we were all learning. Right. Right? And it's not I bet you, you know, a ton of those kids didn't even feel that way deep down. Right, you right. know, it's just that they were taught under the same rules of patriarchy, which I hate using terms like that because it makes it seem so abstract. But we were all taught the same garbage lessons, right, and that's kind of what made that's what makes those moments happen. It's not necessarily that those people are bad, yeah, you know. It's not necessarily that those people are bad.
I think that kind of reminds me of what we were talking about before in terms of being an extrovert or being social or getting that kind of getting juiced off of other people. I of course use meth because I cook it at home, so that's not me, but getting that energy from other people. Again, it's like, speaking of cliches, it's like, well, let's open up, you know, Psychology Today and read the article about how much healthier of a life you as an individual will have if you are an optimist or if you are able to sort of see something compassionately, because that allows you also to not, it's not necessarily about letting someone walk all over you or letting someone hold on to a judgment that you then accept about yourself, but that it's more about like, well, if I can make this about something bigger than myself, then it's not as personal. Like, and so it's yeah, healthier. Yeah. It's long-term, seems to me, healthier for your mind, heart, and body to not internalize it and make it just about you. Only you. You're ugly. You're this. You're that. If you can right. take it in that context, in that larger context, and place yourself as part of a bigger, you know, set of problems, if you will, unfortunately, then there is a way out of that. And the other thing I was thinking too is, because I had some experiences getting bullied when I was in school, is did you have an awareness at all then? Because I feel like I had, it's hard to remember because everything kind of starts stacking up in one heap sure. of feelings. But I feel like even then I remember having this absurd sense of like, but in the movies, like, you cheer for the, like you're on the side of the person who's getting bullied. Like, you want, those are the protagonists. The protagonists are me, the person who's not being let to sit down on the bus. Like, in a story, we all, don't right, we like that right. person? And trying to right. sort of, you know, reckon with that and trying to, like, have that conversation. Like, well, I guess I'd rather be the person in the movie. Like, you know, how do I make this abstract and make this about being a character, or what matters to me is, you know, is, like, the world of cinema, which, you know, or television, which is like imaginary, but you kind of want to believe it exists for a reason. So, well, God, there must be more people like me if we're all rooting for that character in that John Hughes movie or that character in that Disney movie or whatever, right, you know, example you're using. It's pretty rare that like the jerk is, except in the movie The Jerk starring Steve Martin now, but like the you know, that the bully is like, that's not the person that anyone's rooting
right,
for in the movie.
We don't root for that person. You know? Yeah, no. And I wonder, I mean, that's a really good question. Like, do we sort of subconsciously know because of the media diet that we're fed that we, that ultimately us, the shit upon person, it like wins the day. And that's a good question. I think maybe there was some kind of subconsciousness working there. But for me, I think I always just thought, let me get to college, mm-hmm, and this will sort itself out. Yeah. I did always think, I'm just going to get to college. I'm just going to get to college. I'm just going to get to college. And I will experience the great reset. And if this, none of this will matter. And I think, and that's like actually very true, because I did get to college. We still had hot girls, but it didn't matter. Like, it just, right, they didn't have the same power. Right. You know what I mean? And then also, you know, I also needed to get away from, you know, my parents were very strict. I didn't have the same kind of freedoms that other kids did. I needed to get away from all of that.
Mm. Do you have brothers and sisters?
And I have a brother, but he's 13 years older than me.
Oh, yeah. You're an only child.
I was functionally an only child. Yeah. Yeah.
And wait, let me ask you this real quick, and I'm so sorry to interrupt, but to put contextually now, I'm curious. Was there like a functioning mosque like in Palm Springs? I mean, if there was only one other family that you knew of, in terms of like a kid at your school, how'd that work?
No, we didn't. So my dad had been practicing for a long time, but then sort of like dropped off of like actually of serious practice when I was a kid.
Gotcha.
And then we lived with my grandparents for some time, and they would just, you know, it's interesting. They would just, they would like pray five times a day, and my grandmother would cover herself, and they wouldn't eat this and they wouldn't drink that, blah 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 blah, but they didn't proselytize at all. Mm. So my relationship with Islam was like a very much a la carte optional situation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, it was, no one was ever like, practice this, do that. Even my, you know, like I said, I was with hardcore Muslims for years. They lived with us and they never said a word to me. You know what I mean? Yeah. They were just like, I don't know. And I think that's partly a little bit more of a, like an Iranian quality. Mm. I also think it's more my family, they were just real hands off with like any kind of like ideological impositions. Yeah. It's like they were like way more judgmental about like how I tweezed my eyebrows than anything having to do with like an value based system. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, so my relationship with Islam was super chill.
Got it. Got it.
Growing up. Yeah.
Well, that's also an interesting, I mean, that's very much, I think, something that is being talked about now and has been for some time, but like is something that maybe more people feel comfortable having a discussion outside of their own social groups or outside of their own cultural groups. But this idea of the blending or how do you tease apart culture versus religion, you know, that there's like, you could self-identify as a Jew, and that doesn't mean you ever go to temple or observe any holidays, right, or kosher or anything, but do you still get to call yourself that? Yes, you do. That's a culture as much, you know, as well as it is a religion. And and are there, you know, who's drawing the lines between the nomenclature and like what you are, who you are, where you come from? All of that stuff is so intermingling.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think the way that I got it was like, first of all, the praying always seemed like this kind of zen-like, mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Like this kind of like, oh, this is like, you know, it's like turning on Enya a few times a day and like just taking a moment. Like it had more of a zen, the way I viewed it. It's funny because you watch footage on Fox News, again, talking about like how we perceive things. You watch footage on Fox News, like a Muslim prayer seemed like this crazy, like, you know, call to arms, like, look at all these people bowing and da da da. But like if you strip away the commentary, you're like, oh, they're just kind of like meditating. That's nice. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just, you just look at it differently.
That's, you know,
and then
what?
It's suddenly
this,
a different perception.
I'm uncomfortable with this. It is not nearly as normal as putting a wafer in your mouth and pretending it's the body of a human being who died a few years ago. That kind of thing makes sense.
No, and so I think, right, so like, I think the cultural components, so it's like, I grew up around it, around that aspect. I grew up around, like, not eating certain things or not drinking certain things, to the point where, like, even to this day, if I have bacon, which I do, I feel like I'm doing something wrong, because we just aggressively didn't have it in the home, right? And also, just like, there, you know, coming from like traditionally Muslim country, it was like there's just more strict rules about, you know, women and what they should do and not do. And and my parents are like ultimately very progressive. Look, they gave birth to a comedian. You know what I mean? They supported my career. I went and got a master's degree in African American studies, another one in public policy, worked for the city of New York as a policy advisor, and then quit all of that to literally become a comedian. And they just were like, we stand by you. We don't understand, but we stand
by
you.
That's so great.
So like, it's so great. And I think, so my parents are just an odd mixture of, you're not allowed to have a boyfriend, but also that's go to the other side of the country and be, you know, I went to school in upstate New York at Cornell, and I remember, you know, meeting other Iranian girls whose parents wouldn't let them leave like within 50 miles of their hometown, you know? So I think that also, has to do with the fact that we didn't have the social pressures of other Iranian families. Mm. So a lot of times you meet someone who, let's say, grew up in Dearborn, Michigan or something, and there's like a ton of Muslims there. Maybe the largest percentage of Muslims in the United States are in Dearborn. And you have way more social pressures of what you should do, how you should behave with their children as a parent, what you should allow them to do and not do. And then there's, you know, there's the peer pressure that comes from having Muslim friends. I just didn't have any of that. Yeah. And because there, I just didn't have a cohort of Iranians, you know.
Why were you? How did you end up? How did your folks end up settling in Palm Springs? Was it just work stuff?
Because we were in... I was born in New Haven, but then my dad ended up in Virginia. We ended up in Virginia for many years, where it was and I was a baby, so it was their main like sticking point with Virginia was that it was a little racist. Like, they were in a part of Virginia that was racist. One of my earliest memories is my brother coming home from middle school with a black eye or whatever, because someone was like, you know, you dirty Iranian or whatever. Like, Iranians were very hated in the 80s, specifically hated. I know they've never been like just like adored or anything in America, but like in the 80s they were very, very hated. And so my brother was like a kid and was being, you know, was you know, beaten up and stuff like that for being Iranian. And so my parents were just a buddy of my dad's called, and my dad's a surgeon, and he was like, dude, like, you've got to come to Palm Springs. Like, there's so many old people. They have heart attacks all the time. Like, this is where the business be at, you know? And so
the second wave of the gold rush in California is old people dying
for
doctors.
You go where the market is. You go where the market is. And so, yeah, so I ended up and I'm really grateful that for that random call, because my childhood was vastly different from what my brother had to experience in high school, because I had the buffer of tons of Mexicans. You know what I mean? We didn't have the same kind of like racial dynamics, because I had so many Mexicans around me. Now, did I wish to just sometimes be blended into the Mexican community? Yes, like that. And it's just kind of what I think as a default, a lot of people just assumed I was Mexican, you know, and that was fine. It worked out.
Yeah. Me too. Same. Growing up in Tucson.
Right? A ton of Mexicans. Right. I went to upstate New York for college, and I was like, I'm sorry. Where do I find all of the Mexicans? I don't understand. Yeah. I was stunned by how few Mexicans there were in upstate New York. I just didn't get
I just have not wandered that far afield. Like, I'm such a West Coast person and I'm such a Southern West Coast person. It's kind of sad. Right. Like, but that is what I know. And I think I was even like relieved in San Francisco. I was like, oh, we're still good. Okay, we're still good. And obviously I was kidding, saying that like I could pass for Mexican, but that was definitely something, you know, like it wasn't the worst thing in the world for me to, you know, have cultural envy of the majority of kids I was going to elementary school and you know, with like, and those holidays feeling more significant to me. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful.
Right. And
I'm
it's
so
also
grateful
like
that I had white shame from such a young age. I really am just so grateful for that. It's really been with me a long time.
It's also like reverse teen movie.
Yeah.
Right? Where like you, I want to see that teen movie.
Oh, man.
You know, because we're used to the other. To the other narrative, but I had that cultural envy as a member of a minority group whose minority membership was so small.
Ugh,
it didn't warrant categorization. You know, so I was very much in a similar boat.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
Video games.
Video games.
Video games. You like them?
Maybe you wish you had more time for them?
Maybe you want to know the best ones to play?
Maybe you want to know what happens to Mario when he dies?
In that case, you should check out Triple Click. It's a podcast about video games.
A podcast about video games? But I don't have time for that.
Sure you do. Once a week, kick back as three video game experts give you everything from critical takes on the hottest new releases,
to scoops, interviews, and explanations about how video games work,
to fascinating and sometimes weird stories about the games we love.
Triple Click is hosted by me, Kirk Hamilton.
Me, Jason Schreier.
And me, Maddie Myers.
You can find Triple Click wherever you get your podcasts and listen at MaximumFun.org.
Bye.
I feel like I could stay on the phone with you for 7 hours. I guess that's not respectful of your time, but I play a game of MASH at the end of my episodes, and I do want to get into that. And I'm excited. Okay, so first category for you. There's so much I didn't cover because I was gabbing at you about so many other things that I've treasured and enjoyed so much. However, I'm like, oh yeah, what was, now did we get into much more of what we liked except for politics as a high school student? So this is my chance to crack open some more knowledge about you at teenage you and current you. But let's start with three collaborations with comedians from perhaps another era, even if that era is like 10 years ago. Three comedians from any time that you get to kind of collaborate on something with, whatever that is.
Wait, so I'm supposed to list three comedians that I would love
to
collaborate with?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have explained this better. And then at the end of this MASH game, so I'm going to throw some different categories at you, and you just kind of speak from, you know, extemporaneously what you're in the mood for right now. Know that it's married to it for the rest of your life, even though this is a 100% guaranteed alternate universe you. Then at the end, like, we'll figure out which thing you ended up with. So you have one from each category that will be your gift.
Okay, so three comedians that I would love to work with are Paul F. Tompkins, which he's been on my show. He's a person I know, but I'm a fan.
Yeah, I can never get enough of him, and he's a dear friend, and I couldn't agree more.
So Paul F. Tompkins, Lucille Ball, oh my gosh, this is such a tough Rory Scovel. I don't know. Those three.
I can't wait to tell Rory. I mean, listen, you felt like a Hail Mary. You felt like she was really digging at the bottom of the barrel of ideas. And
no!
I'm totally kidding. Okay.
But It's funny because, no, this I'll tell you, Rory Scovel is one of the first names that popped into my head. He's a comedian that I don't know. I feel like I should have been on a lineup with him at some point, but I never have been. And he, but I got nervous because I had three white people in my mix.
Understood. Understood.
So anyways, don't at me, folks.
Yeah, please don't.
Just, those were the first three names that came
Please don't.
To me.
Also, let's remember, we are all subject to the rules of this patriarchy that we've all grown up in, and that's what we...
Yes.
No, listen, we do that every... Listen, for Sketchfest every year, we're like, when you start talking about paying tribute to someone who was famous like 50 years ago, it's a sad state of affairs.
Oh,
you're like,
hard.
What white guy should it's we tribute hard. This one? And they're wonderful. You know what I mean? Like, who doesn't want to pay
yeah,
tribute to Gene
totally.
Wilder? But then but you start
Completely.
Stacking them up in this day and age, and you're like, oh yeah. Like, I'm so excited
yeah.
for, you know, 30 years from now, like the incredible diversity I hope is being celebrated
yes.
and looked back upon is going to be like
yes.
unrecognizable to 50 years ago.
Yes.
Okay. Next category. Let's do three places in the world that you would love to have like a second home. And we're just gonna pretend that COVID's not a thing and we can and teleport you there. So you don't have to worry about the travel, even though we've discovered that the travel keeps you going. So if you, you know, listen, we don't have to remove the travel. That's up to you.
100%. I would be Ilha Grande, which is an island off the coast of Rio in Brazil. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. There are no cars and it's just
Ooh.
Like the most magical place. I would love a second home in Paris because I spent a couple of years living in Paris and I really love
it's
it.
Wonderful.
And I think it's the best.
It's so wonderful.
Second only to New York City. And then I really love the Hawaii.
Beautiful.
The Hawaii.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Okay. Next category, three foods that in this reality, maybe you're allergic to it or feels like sort of ecologically unsound to be producing what's being produced, or it's so sugary that you can't eat a bunch of it or you'll feel sick. We're stripping all of that away in this alternate universe. Everything is sort of the same level of like, yeah, it's all great. No one's getting hurt. Three things that you would love to have in perpetuity that we're going to give you at the snap of your fingers. With no ramifications.
Three foods that I would eat in perpetuity with no ramifications are mac and cheese.
Hell yeah.
Oh my God, some sort of like a pad Thai,
yeah.
like Thai noodle concoction.
Yes, indeed.
And a, first, I mean, there's again, this is the third thing that came to mind, molten chocolate cake.
Beautiful. Great. Okay. Okay, next category, let's do three bands or singer-songwriters, composers, three musicians that we're going to, they have magically crafted an album
yeah.
of songs
yeah.
for you that just sort of encapsulates
yes.
you, your heart, your life, your past, all of that.
Right. It's Bjork, Bono, and Tunyards.
That you had that answer so fast. I'm very impressed. Gorgeous. Okay. I love it. All right. All due respect to your wonderful companion in life. This is a MASH game. Three
okay.
people.
No, I won't tell
any
them.
Characters, any, I don't care where they come from, how old they are, whether they're real or not, if it's an actor who played something, whatever. It's up to you. Three romance alternate universe.
Three romance alternate universe. Ah! Okay, John Cusack in the 80s.
Yeah.
Oh my God, what's the name of that? Oscar Isaacs currently. And Sterling K. Brown.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Okay, beautiful. All right, next category. Let's do three books that you can jump into whenever you want and just be in that reality, like hanging with those characters. And if it's hard, yeah.
Oh.
And if books is posing a challenge because those are the things I remember least, even though I consume a million audiobooks a day, you can branch it out into like a movie or something.
Sure. Okay, so Fleshman's in Trouble.
Great.
Anchorman, because you said I could do a
yep,
movie.
Yep.
And Miranda July's Me and You and Everyone We Know.
That's so good.
I feel like unheralded movie that absolutely everyone should watch. Just like side note.
I agree. I her brain is so special.
It's so special. She's actually also like, so, yeah, I would also throw her into making me an album. Like, you
absolutely.
Know, she's just so, you, she absolutely. Could do anything. She's so crazy. And awesome.
I will say, and I'm very embarrassed by this, and I don't know if I've said this ever before on the podcast, this was many years ago, but I saw her at a health food store in Los Angeles. And I hadn't been doing my podcast that long. But we don't have any friends in common that I know of. We probably do. And it's probably someone cool like Zach Galifianakis. Like, oh, Zach's my key to everyone who's cool outside of comedy somehow. But I didn't, I was like, I don't think I'm ever going to, it was that moment where I was like, I do not approach people ever in any circumstance unless it's peer to peer, because I just don't want to make someone uncomfortable, nor do I want to feel like a total loser, which is like, loser is in the eye of the beholder on that one, but that is how I would feel. And I was like, I may never have this
you
opportunity again
yourself.
and I want you to imagine that yes, it did go exactly as you would expect it would with someone like that, who's sort of semi-existing in real life, but also like has their head somewhere else. It was like vague sort of puzzlement, like, okay. And I was like, I wasn't forming words well, you know, I was leaning on comedy. Like, it was awful. It was awful. I was like, I have a podcast. I've interviewed some great ladies, like spit out a few names that I hoped would be meaningful to her. And then I was like, okay, and then I was already apologizing, like encouraging her not to ever contact me, like actively being like, but don't, please don't act on this. But I needed to, but please don't, but I'm so sorry, but I'm really so sorry. And surprisingly, I never heard from her. How strange.
Well, you told her not to.
I really,
yeah. But the funny thing is, I had, this is very recently, actually, right before the pandemic, I was up for a part on a Mike Mills movie, who is her husband, and who also was a brilliant filmmaker. Yeah. And so I got a callback or whatever. And so I got more of a chance. I didn't get this part, sadly, but I got a chance to like kind of hang out with Mike Mills for a minute. And I was just like, hey, listen, I really think your wife is like the best ever. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, he's like, she's better than me. And I know, like, and the way, like, he was basically like, this happens to me all the time. You know what I mean? And it's funny, like, he's a famous director. Yeah. Like, he's not a non-famous director. He's a famous director. But I was just like, and then I was just like, no, but just so we're clear, like, I really, really think she's wonderful. And he's like, no, I get it. Like, I get it. Please stop. You know what I mean? Like, please stop. And
that makes me feel better.
He was really nice about it. But I was just like, oh my God, I spent so much of my audition to Mike Mills, like, telling him that his wife was the most wonderful person ever.
That does make you feel better. It's a weird indirect way of making me feel better, so thank you for
that. After that, he really couldn't give me the part, because I would just I would essentially be stalking his wife.
He made the decision not to
he's the only thing he
I
could
definitely
do.
Get it. Okay, next to last category, three real life skills that you have the opportunity to have that you wake up with tomorrow and you're just like extraordinarily great at something, whether you are competent now or don't know how to do it at all.
I would really love to be one of those people that can play any song on the piano after hearing it. I would really love to be one of those people that like can look at like financial documents and or like, you know, Wall Street whatevers and be like, oh, totally.
Yeah.
And like completely understand it. And I would really love to be one of those intuitive people who can intuitively cook, like without looking at a recipe.
Great. God, that was a great use of the category. Okay. And then final category for thee. Let's do three places and times that you can visit. You're in a safety bubble. You're sort of not visible to the world. You're an observer, but you get to see either a specific event or just like an era in time and place that would be fascinating to see. Three.
Yeah, I think it would be really interesting to see the Prohibition era, like the 20s, yeah. for some reason. I find that fascinating. I think it would be super interesting to be dropped into the French Revolution. Yeah. Just like, I'm not like a violent seeker or anything, but just like, I don't know, the ideas and the fervor and the, yeah. whatever. Like, it would be interesting to see that. I would love... I'd also love to have been in New York City in the 60s with like the movement building and everything that happened here.
Love it. Love it. The first two in particular, but actually the third one to some degree as well, like I feel a hunger to see things that only feel mythological to me, even though I very much know they existed. It's so hard to imagine just like the day in, day out of a Prohibition era, like being a gangster's mole. Yeah. Like, what?
Right. Because they were still like waking up, picking up a bagel. You know what I mean? There was still like a funny quotidian aspect to like the life of a gangster in the 20s. I mean, it's just like hustling beers 100%. Or whatever. But just the idea, like the entire country wasn't allowed to drink, but obviously everybody was. Like, oh, that to me is also, it's just really crazy. Yeah,
those extremes are incredibly fascinating. Okay, give me a number between 1 and 7.
5.
Okay. Will you, while I do these calculations, please tell people the things that they should be paying attention to of yours in all the ways?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yes, I would love if you would listen to my podcast, Fake the Nation. So it is a political comedy podcast. It's a roundtable. And every week I have two different comedians and we kvetch about the news and about other dumb things happening culturally. So it's people like Margaret Cho was just on. Samantha Bee was just on. Julian Castro, presidential nominee, was on. David Cross, Bill Nye, the science guy. So we have like a really fun and eclectic panel of usually comedians, and we break it down and it's super fun. So you could check out Fake the Nation and also my book, How to Make White People Laugh, and I have like writings and all that stuff all over the internet.
That timed out so perfectly, I can't even tell you. So thank God you didn't have one more credit or I would have shut you down. I would have played the Academy music. I'd peel you off the stage. No, that was gorgeous. I am very excited. I'll tell you why. I'm excited about this because there's a level of like there's just no snobbery happening here. There's like a real high low deliciousness about these results. Let me start by describing the endless gorgeous mac and cheese that you will be eating inside your shack in Paris, France. Just as one example.
Oh, that sounds great.
You know what I mean? Or like the fact that you can jump into Anchorman whenever you want, but you also have a custom album created for you in admiration by Bjork. Like, I love those side besides. You know what I mean? I love that you have collaborated with Lucille Ball. And I think that's the kind of person who's really going to appreciate the fact that you can just play any song on piano. Like, this old thing? This thing I just heard a little snippet of that I could now play the entire thing?
Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling. Hello, my ragtime
Well, it's
gal.
Funny that you would that's bring that era up because... You may be in high demand if you decide to unveil yourself. I know you're invisible and safe when you visit the Prohibition era, but we'll give you the option of uncloaking yourself and making music, playing some maybe some ragtime as you visit that mythic era of time.
And I'll be
in
a flapper outfit 100%.
Yeah. I know the person who's going to appreciate that and who I feel like I've seen in 1920s attire and he cuts a very nice jib is none other than the wonderful Sterling K. Brown.
Oh, beautiful.
I mean, this is a very positive
that
outcome.
That is a scene.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I love
that. I just want you to bathe in those MASH results because you've earned it. You're wonderful.
Thank you.
I've had such a pleasure doing this. I hope I count as one of the 15 people that you need to have a genuine interaction with today, because this has been a pleasure and
a joy.
It
wasn't long enough, Janet.
Oh, my gosh.
No, this was fantastic. Thank you so much.
So
I love talking to you.
I could not feel more the same. I really hope that when the fog lifts, we get a chance to be around each other in real life. That would be very, very pleasurable.
In person. Let's get a latte. It'll be
It's gonna
nice.
Be great. I like oat milk. It's true. I'm one of those people. Wonderful. Okay. For everyone else listening, I appreciate you. I cherish you, and I will talk to you next time on the podcast. The show is recorded by me and edited by Julian Burrell. And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
Hey, remember when we could save kittens from trees, or lunch on skyscrapers, bring the villains to their knees? Maybe we should someplace new and build time machines to go and get us back.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.